Good afternoon and welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring our panel speaking on the topic of South African democracy, lessons from 30 years. My name is Sunday Goshit, and I am one of the board members of the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, and I'm your host for today's program. We want to thank you and thank all our sponsors and community partners for their support. In particular, today we recognize the Iowa City Public Library for their partnership and the refreshments served today. And a big thank you to the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the University of Iowa Political Science Department for sponsoring this program and supporting ICFRC's Democracy Series. Our other series sponsors can be found on the posters on your table. Before we turn to the program, I would like to tell you about the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council New Fall 2024 series, Democracy at a Crossroads, Perspectives and Insights at Home and Around the World. We're really excited about this incredibly important seven-part series. The first six precede the November elections, and the final program will be 2 weeks after. Do check our information, including our full list of amazing sponsors, on one of the flyers on your tables and on our website, icfrc.org. As part of this series, at the start of our programs, we're inviting Iowans to share for 2 minutes their answers to two questions. And I'd like to turn the microphone to Peter Gellag, our executive director, to welcome today's two guests.
Thank you, Sunday. Ryan and Ambassador McMullen, would you come up, please, and join me over here? So before these democracy series programs, I want to come up. We're talking with regular Iowans about their own views about the upcoming election, but more specifically, the subject of democracy. Before I turn the microphone over to the two of them, I want to point out the posters that Sunday mentioned that are on your tables. For those of you, if this is your first time at one of these Democracy Series programs, we have on one side the full lineup of the seven-part series. And so you can see the programs that we have done, as well as the two that are upcoming yet after today's program. On the other side of that poster, you'll see that we have voting resources. Our goal here is to have people be as informed as possible, knowing where and how to vote early voting or on the day of the election. So do check that out. So what I'll do now is I'm going to ask these two wonderful people two questions. The first is, what does democracy mean to you? And the second, why is democracy important in today's world? So, Ryan?
Okay. Peter has chosen me to answer these two very deceptively difficult questions. So I think to do the basic definition of, you know, it's governance and the creation of a society based on the voice of everyone that's a part of it. And I think it's exceptionally important for us because, as I think we all probably know, the people governing us don't always make the decisions that we think are best for us or that we most agree with. And so, of course, we have an election coming up. So obviously that's through voting, but it's also through protesting and peaceful protesting and making your voice heard through talking to representatives and, you know, moving bodies together to make your voice and opinions and statements heard, specifically when those decisions that are being made are not the ones that you back and agree. So that is my very vague answer to these two questions.
Yeah, hi, I'm Ron McMullen. I used to be an American diplomat, and American diplomats are kind of missionaries for democracy. It's one of the values that we support, and, you know, if we weren't a democracy, the very essence of being an American is people ruling themselves. That was what the American Revolution was all about. I mean, we're not Canadians, right? So we were a revolutionary country formed under this radical notion that people can rule themselves. And not only do we believe that we're better off as a democracy, but we believe other countries would be better off if they were democracies as well, and we'd be better off if they were democracies as well. There's the notion of a democratic peace where democracies don't fight each other. There's a correlation between democratic governance and economic prosperity, that the feedback that governing people get from elections keeps policies on track, typically. And so it's really important for me as an American to be proud of our system of government. When I was a diplomat, I served twice as an election observer, once in South Africa, once in the Fiji Islands. As a professor here at the University of Iowa, I always ask for a write-in ballot, a mail-in ballot, excuse me. And so I get my ballot before the election and take it and show it to my international students. I said, have you ever seen an American ballot? You know, we have elections here. Maybe you don't in your country, but this is what a ballot looks like. And these are the choices that we Americans get to make about how we're going to select our government for the upcoming years. And that's always kind of a fun thing to share my mail-in ballot with international students. So, I think it's part of the essence of America is being a democracy. That was what our revolution is all about. That's why we're not Canadians. I mean, Canadians are democracy as well, but they didn't have a revolution to throw off sort of a monarchy. Eventually, you know, Canada's all right, but we revolted and started this notion that people can rule themselves.
Thank you both very much. Yes, so please get informed, please be engaged, and please, please do vote. Yeah. Sunday, back to you.
Thank you so much, Peter, and thank you. I would like to introduce our two wonderful speakers. Brady Giselle is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. Her research examines the intersection of citizenship, kinship, and economy in the everyday lives of South African families. As the availability of wage labor declines globally, she researches how women rework the obligations entailed by kinship and citizenship in order to combat their social and economic insecurity. Drawing on approaches from feminist anthropology, women's history, and gender theories of capital, her work considers how intimate relationships such as those between couples or kin reproduce or transform both economic inequalities and political belonging. She addresses these questions in South Africa, where gender, race, and work mark the shifting boundaries of political inclusion. Tuto Tipe is a historian of 19th and 20th century South Africa, focusing on social and legal histories. She's an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Chicago, and holds a PhD in History and African American Studies from Yale University, Master's in Gender Studies from the University of Cape Town, where she also held positions as a lecturer and researcher, and a BA from Macalester University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Giselle, who is going to start, and Dr. Tipe, who is joining us remotely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And I apologize for the lateness. I am a PhD who can't read an email. Maybe you've heard of them before. But I am really grateful to Sunday, and I'm grateful to Peter for the opportunity to be here today, and especially excited to be able to be joined by Dr. Tipe, who is a longtime colleague and brilliant scholar, so we'll, hopefully you'll see the ways in which our work dovetails. So just a moment to say, you know, I'm standing before you, yes, I'm an assistant professor in anthropology and gender, women's, sexuality studies, but I come to you talking from over two decades of work in South Africa, studying Zulu, working with women on women's empowerment issues. My degree is both in anthropology and history, which is wonderful, so I get to hang out more with people like Dr. Tipe. But I often introduce myself to the folks that I'm with in South Africa as simultaneously a student, a listener, and a teacher. But oftentimes the identities that have more salience is that I'm also a daughter, a mother, and a wife. And so I live these realities in overlapping ways, and they continue to constantly inform the research that I do. So this the project that I'm talking about today and inspiring thinking about, you know, comparisons between South Africa and today is that this year we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of South Africa's democracy. And I think that gives a wonderful entree for reflecting on the meaning of democracy in newer democracies and, if you will, older democracies such as ours, but also democracies that are also somewhat tenuous, as in many ways ours is. My questions around this particular project sort of began in the post-1994 moment. The realities were large levels of unemployment, particularly for Black South African women, right, over 40%. And although there was this you know, ebullience and joy over the possibilities of life under the new democracy, the lived realities were very complicated. So, you know, part of what intensive levels of unemployment led to was also a decline in marriage rates, because many Black South Africans formalized their marriage through bride wealth exchange, which is deeply meaningful. And what those two things together meant is, you know, that high levels of poverty, low levels of marriage, but of course people want to live lives, build families, and children are absolutely beloved and cherished and an important part of, you know, continuing life as an adult. So of course people were having families. And my question centered around how are women who are overwhelmingly caring for the children making it in South Africa, in the new South Africa? How are they getting enough resources to support their children? How are they getting by? So that's what I came with. But of course, when you talk to people, your questions change. And I distinctly remember a moment in 2014, which was an election year in South Africa, when I was talking to a friend of mine, Nokutula. And Nokutula was in her 30s. In 2014, and so had grown up under the, you know, the last few years of apartheid, grown up to see the shift into democracy, and this was the third, you know, this was the first, no, this was the second election in which she could vote. And I'm, you know, she was a longtime political activist, and I'm saying, oh, you know, how's it going to be? This is exciting. You're doing, you know, utilizing your citizenship, you're going to vote. And she said, of course I'm going to vote. I'm always going to vote. But let's be clear, Brady, I'm not a citizen. And I'm not a citizen because I can barely feed my children. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, I understand. And then I stopped and I said, but do I understand? Do I actually understand what she means? And so that led me onto my larger research project, which is what I want to talk about today, which is thinking about what does citizenship mean for in democratic South Africa, and what does citizenship mean for those people like Nokutula who stood the most to gain from a democratic transition, right? So unlike their mothers, unlike their grandmothers, they can vote in the elections. They can own property with a caveat, and Dr. Tipe will talk a little bit about this. They can take an absentee father to court if he's not supporting them. They can retain custody of their children. They have a host of rights that they could never dream of, but she's still saying that she's not a citizen. So what does that mean? And I did just on the 30th anniversary, if you will, this summer publish a book. It's at Prairie Lights, if you're interested. That's my book. But this is the work that led up to that. So for a bit of a background and to those who might not know, the South African Constitution is sort of widely thought to be the most comprehensive and progressive in the world. And again, for context, democratic independence came in 94. This constitution was drafted in 96. And so part of what it does is it enshrines a host of rights that are often thought of in terms of generational rights. So first generation rights are probably what everybody thinks of when they think about democracy and when they think about the sort of enlightenment ideals of democracy, right? Those are rights to equality, non-discrimination, life, dignity, privacy, and all those fundamental freedoms such as freedom of expression, freedom of association, assembly, opinion, belief. There are also particular ones, particularly to South Africa, which is freedom and the security of the person, which protects against detention without trial, which we know about here, but also protects the rights to make reproductive decisions. That's in their Bill of Rights written in. Not only does South Africa protect first-generation rights, the Bill of Rights also protects second-generation rights, which are more of those social and economic rights. Which is very unique. It's one of the first constitutions to do that. So it also protects access to food, adequate food, water, housing, healthcare, social security, things about the rights to education, and then the special rights of children who regard, and as opposed to this idea of access to, actually have the right to basic nutrition, shelter, basic healthcare services, and social services. Now, all of those we understand are positive obligations of a government to actually spend things. So as opposed to protecting against things, these are places where the government has to invest money, right? And so that access to is a really important clause in that first provision, because in many ways limitations of budget or limitations of discretion have meant that a lot of folks continue to not have access to these really important basic provisions. The other element of second generation rights is social rights and cultural rights. So the right to use one's language of choice and participate in one's cultural group, which can take place anywhere or can take place in sort of demarcated territories that Dr. Tipe will talk about. Again, this starts to look really different from something that we're familiar with. And then the third generation of rights are these environmental rights, which start to think beyond the individual, which South Africa and a handful of new constitutions is really radical in doing. What does it mean to bestow rights not to persons, but groups and larger entities? So the idea that there is a collectively held right to an environment that's not harmful to people's health and well-being. The idea that there is rights to have the environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations. These are very new, taking the form of in the UNHCR and UN. Human Rights Commission, starting to be formulated, but starting to be picked up more and more with the Sustainable Development Goals. Other key provisions that got baked into the South African Constitution were explicit protections around gender inequity. So, explicit support for gender and equity in the form of protecting women's freedoms, creating equal representation in politics through things like quotas, and sort of many more things. This isn't just an add-on, but the ways in which women's groups were actively involved in framing the Constitution, right? So this produces a really powerful document on paper. But part of what it's pushing back against and why it's so incredibly robust is it's trying to redress long-time historic divisions. And I want to give you just the briefest sense of what those were. So starting in the 19th century, and I promise there's not a slide for every century, or for every decade, don't worry. I talk about the 19th century because it had really enduring effects. There was this bifurcation of political status that happened, and it was somewhat along race, but race was a lot more malleable than pure phenotype. Geography was an important part of this. Religion was an important part of this. So the South African population got divided up into British citizens who overwhelmingly lived in cities, practiced Christian marriage, who had formal mission education, and because of that status, had a number of votes of rights, such as voting rights, property rights, received welfare support or poverty relief, as it was in the early days, but then got elaborated going further. In contrast, overwhelmingly black Africans, although there were some who were able to fall into that British citizen category, overwhelmingly were relegated to native reserves. There's a likening to reservations that can take place in terms of what the U.S. did with Native Americans in terms of removing people from their native land and requiring them to live in protected reserves. It's not a one-to-one comparison, but it's, you know, an easy shorthand. Those folks practiced traditional marriage. They had very little formal education. And all of the rights that they did have were sort of under the rule of whatever tribal leadership ran those native reserves. So there wasn't property rights. There wasn't voting rights. They also weren't legally allowed to live in the city. And any poverty that took place sustained the populations that were on them, you know, dramatically decreased, was considered the responsibility of the African family. The African family. This is in government documents. Poverty is the responsibility of the African family, which translates to black women, overwhelmingly. And under this system, black women had no rights. They were perpetually legal minors. So subject to the rule of husbands or subject to the rule of overwhelmingly male tribal leaders. This gets hardened. These divisions get hardened over time, both in the segregationist era and then in apartheid, which began in 48 and then ended in 94. And as I think about it, you know, there were many things going on, but for the purpose of my initial question, which goes back to Nokutulo's provocation, I think about sort of who got to be mothers of the nation, in part because that was a discourse that was really very potent in various forms of activism. So over the course of these intervening decades, turnovers of white leadership who have this abiding fear about a kind of twofold, well, threefold problem. One, it's a very small white population. Number two, concerns about white poverty, which really makes that racial hierarchy hard to argue for, because you get a lot of white folks acting, quote unquote, uncivilized. And then number three, how to bring in the sort of majority of black African labor into an economy that's very hungry for their labor without bestowing them full citizenship rights. And so this hinges on, again, this division between belonging and unbelonging. So the mothers of the nation, as framed by white women, get this robust protection. They get a racial system or a welfare system sort of built to support their families, create educated children, enhance housing, enhance nutrition. They get pensions. They get training in mothering and this overwhelming system. Whereas black South Africans get not only excluded, but actually the uplift of the white population hinges on the downgrading of black Africans. For example, there is a job reservation policy whereby well-paying jobs and the highest level jobs are reserved for white folks and are paid at levels above what they are even in Britain. So there are British white South Africans in South Africa making more than they are than their British counterparts in England. And that was made possible economically by paying Africans less, to the extent that they make almost, in some cases, one-fifth what white folks do. Under the auspices that that uncivilized persons simply needed less to survive on. And again, any poverty that existed wasn't compensated for with things like mothers' pensions or family wages, but was compensated for, again, by this sort of African family system. And then at the same time, what you get is a pass system that prohibits black Africans from living in the cities unless they're working. And when they're working, they can obtain a pass that gives them access to the city for a short period of time. And when it expires, if they lose their job or if they want to switch their job, but they haven't yet, that expires and they have to go back to their homelands and their rural areas. Again, so this very tenuous hold on the city. So my point with this, it's the only three slides to cover 100, or two slides to cover 150 years, which is painful for a historian, and I apologize to Dr. Tipe. My point is with all of this is that for 150 years, full citizenship in South Africa meant, yes, voting rights. White women got the vote in 1930. Yes, property rights. Yes, legal protections. But also all of these other supports. So jobs at inflated wages, housing, education, old age pensions, and really robust support for child rearing. So that's part of what undergirds Nokutula's statements. Not just the imagining of what the new constitution says, but knowing this longer history that her grandmothers and mothers have lived through. So I'm gonna let Dr. Tipe give you a kind of more in-depth example.
We just had an important election in South Africa earlier this year that saw us come to the first coalition government in the country's history. It's a year of big elections around the world, and I'm glad to get to spend a little bit of time today talking with you about questions around citizenship and belonging and resource allocation in democratic South Africa. I'm going to focus on rural parts of South Africa that were under apartheid classified as their own independent states. So Dr. Giselle has provided us a really useful overview of the demarcation of who's a citizen and geographically how that works, of trying to keep cities as white as possible and trying to keep rural areas, trying to restrict black people to rural areas other than when their labor was being used in urban areas. Of course, this wasn't neatly executed. The book that I'm working right now is on a township, an urban township in Johannesburg that that demonstrates the long history of permanent black settlement in urban areas. But these were, for the most part, the exceptions, and most black people were living in rural areas in South Africa. So I'm going to focus on a handful of laws that demonstrate how black people were excluded from citizenship protections and privileges under colonialism and then this entrenched under apartheid, and how the democratic government has tried to navigate reconstituting this bifurcated citizenship structure, and rather than succeeding, has oftentimes fell back on the old colonial models and entrenched a lot of the inequalities that were historically produced. So I'm going to go into greater detail in the next couple of slides about the breakdown of these laws, but very broadly, there's the 1927 Black Administration Act, which gave the Governor General of South Africa the power to create tribes, appoint headmen, and appoint chiefs. So historically in the region, So there are 11 official languages, and there are nine official languages, nine African languages, the other two being English and Afrikaans, but there are nine African official languages in South Africa. So that gives a sense of some of the ethnic diversity in the region and political diversity alongside this. There was more diversity than just the nine. The nine were consolidated under colonialism. But across that spectrum of ethnic groups, there was a range of political systems and types of political organizing. So on the East Coast, with the Zulu Kingdom, you had more centralized power, but still checks and balances, separations of power, systems that people could use to check abuses of power and to have some sort of democratic participation. Further north in the country, with groups like Tswana groups, close to the border of Botswana, there were much more decentralized political systems where there were often splinter groups and people really challenged power in ways that forced democratic participation in, and not just through formal structures, but that leadership knew that the frequency of splinter groups and of leadership being deposed meant that they really had to listen to and be accountable to the people who they governed. So even with this spectrum of more centralized and more decentralized across the region, a core feature was that there were checks and balances, there were separations of powers, and these were built into the cultural, into the social, into the economic system, as with governance systems around the world. So when missionaries first came, they often spoke with old men and asked them, what's the custom in the region? And oftentimes old men said, well, the most powerful people in our society are old men, and they decide what happens and how it happens. So there were those early distortions with the recording and then the codification of indigenous legal and political systems. And then later on, there were more insidious ones where, like with the Native Administration Act, the colonial government outright was deciding who would be a leader, first of all. So to become a leader, you would have to be loyal to the colonial government and show that you could advance colonial interests, most often at the expense of the people who you governed. And then it gave them the power to say, who is a tribe? What is a tribe? So tribe in South Africa is used as a pejorative term to denote this colonial category of social and political organizing. And so the historical processes of checks and balances, accountability, democratic participation were completely done away once colonial administrators gave themselves the power to define groups, define who was part of which group, define who would lead this group, and therefore control the different levels of social and legal administration. So that's the 1927 Act that we see at the bottom. And above that, in 1951, so early years of the apartheid regime, the government introduced tribal authorities, which were a consolidation of different smaller tribes. And this then gave them the geographic boundaries of what would become the Bantustans. So the Bantu Authorities Act gave the government continued a power to create tribes, define leadership, and now with tribal authorities to say that this is the geographic area to which you are bound. And the consolidation of these tribal authorities produced the Bantustans, which the government said were independent states. And so in denying Black people citizenship in South Africa, the government, the apartheid government, argued that they were citizens of their own independent states in the Bantustans, which then they used for international credibility, that they're not, they continue to subscribe to rule of law, and this is a demonstration that Black people have their own citizenship. Of course, this was a farce. The Bantustans were under the control of the South African government. There was extreme repression, extreme violence in creating the Bantustans, and we're going to see that coming along in a few slides. So as Dr. Giselle has explained with the South African Constitution, there was an explicit recognition of past injustice and the harm of colonial and racially based political ordering. And so the government or the Constitution explicitly recognizes one unitary South Africa, universal citizenship for all South Africans, a non-ethnic and a non-racial and non-sexist government. Those are some of the opening lines of the Constitution. So in line with this, legislation that the Democratic government produced explicitly outlines itself as addressing the past harms and creating a more democratic, more inclusive way of governing. So in 2003, the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act was passed by Parliament and was supposed to address the tribal authorities' boundaries that had been dissolved but formally hadn't been replaced with a different form of recognizing indigenous legal and governance systems. But what the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act did was take the categories that the colonial government had produced and rename them. So tribal authorities became traditional councils, chiefs became senior traditional leaders. So they renamed the old ordering system and called the renaming reconstitution while keeping the structures and the functioning of these structures intact. The Traditional Courts Bill in 2004, the CLRA, the Communal Land Rights Act, was adopted by Parliament, but then struck down by the Constitutional Court. And the CLRA proposed to give chiefs the power to decide on land use, land allocation, and land administration in South Africa. So these still undemocratically elected, it's still treated as a hereditary position. These unelected officials were given the power to decide to give and take land across rural parts of the country. And the Constitutional Court struck it down in its entirety. In 2008, Parliament introduced the Traditional Courts Bill. And the Traditional Courts Bill went even further than the CLRA. And it gave traditional leaders the power to decide customary law and put traditional courts on equal footing with magistrates' courts. So it was intended to replace the courts section, the courts and administration sections of the Native Administration Act, which did need legislating to give some sort of framework to how traditional disputes are decided in rural areas. But it did this in the most colonial way. Instead of giving greater power to people in democratic participation, it further centralized power in chiefs and gave them the kinds of authority and power that they had never enjoyed, even under apartheid, to decide the content of customary law. And going back to Dr. Giselle's slides around women using courts for child support, for gender-based violence, for all these protections that are stipulated in the Constitution, in giving traditional courts the same standing as magistrates' courts, one of the chief complaints or concerns that women's or rights organizations put forward was how do women then justify using magistrates' courts rather than traditional courts? And how do you get traditional leaders who are deciding what the content of customary law is to apply the letter of the law and make sure that women's rights are being protected, and that this really put women in an extraordinarily vulnerable position. So the Traditional Courts Bill failed to pass in Parliament through Parliament twice. I was part of I was a researcher in the law school at the University of Cape Town, and one of our main projects was I was organizing against the traditional courts bill. So it was the first bill in democratic South Africa to fail to pass twice in the National Assembly and in the National Council of Provinces. But it was passed in December of 2020 with some amendments. But central was that it kept the boundaries of the former Bantustans as the boundaries of the traditional councils today. Can we move to the next slide? And just for a demonstration of how continuous the traditional leadership and governance framework is with the Bantustans, on the left are the Bantustans. So the yellow was supposed to be the group for Tswana, the homeland for Tswana people, the Tsiskai and the Transkai for Xhosa-speaking people. But each of these are demarcated along ethnic lines, previously called tribal lines. And on the right, we have traditional councils as recognized by the Framework Act. And you can put them on top of each other and virtually have the same boundaries. So the South African government today is saying that traditional leadership is only applicable in areas that are colored in this map, which constitute 13% of the country's landmass, which are the restrictions that the colonial government put on. In 1913, it was 8% of the country's landmass. And in 1936, it was increased to 13%. But we have this parallel governance system and different citizenship rights accorded to people in the 13% versus in the remaining 87%. Can we go to the next slide? A lot of this has been covered in Dr. Giselle's presentation, but just very briefly, I'm going to touch on a few of these. The British, the slide we saw earlier of British citizens' rights and everyone else's rights, Black people's rights, they were Black people who were able to get landholding rights and voting rights under the two British colonies. But the Boer colonies, the two Boer republics, in part had separated because the British, they believed were too lenient. And in those republics, citizenship was even more tightly linked to white identity. So for instance, Resolution 159 of the Transvaal government prohibited anyone who was not a burger from owning land and prohibited Africans from having burger rights. So only white people could become burgers, and they insisted on white people renouncing other citizenships in order to become burghers. And this was intended to keep the British out of their governance affairs. We have here this establishment of the Union of South Africa, the coming together of the Boer and the British republics or colonies as a united white country. And can we move to the next slide? This is a lot of laws and dates restricting Black people to rural areas outside of urban areas. Can we go to the next one? And I'm not going into these in details because the purpose of putting these all here was just to demonstrate the extent to which it was highly legislated. Black people's exclusion from citizenship rights was broadly understood because South Africa was imagined and from its origins conceptualized as a state for white people. And then across the decades, legislation was enacted to specify how Black people be excluded from different types of citizenship rights. Next slide, please. And the next one. So this is a slide showing some of the violence of the creation of the Bantustans. It's comical. It's horrifically comical to imagine that Black people could really have just resided in 13% of a landmass that large. So from the 1930s all the way through the 1980s, there were forced removals that took forced millions of South Africans from the areas where they were living into different homelands. And with this, people were forced into identity categories that they may or may not have identified with themselves and historically may or may not have been part of. But the state decided what a person's tribe was and forced them to live within the boundaries of that. And today, that would be the boundaries of the traditional councils. Next slide, please. And so this is just another map that shows the different ethnic categorizations in the different homelands. Next slide, please. And these are just major political leaders who were denouncing the formalization of tribalism in the Bantustans and in the states, what it called native administration. Next slide. And another major political leader just saying this is inconsistent with African legal political systems and this is a colonial invention. Next slide. So in conclusion, how did we get here? There are a couple of dominant ideas around how the democratic government came to support traditional leadership in the colonial form. One is 80% of known platinum deposits in the world are in the former Botswana and Leboa homelands. And titanium is in the Transkei and Ciskei and all other minerals around the homeland. So it was perceived to be the most undesirable land 80 years ago, and it has turned out to be some of the most valuable land in the world. So in keeping with this really highly centralized political model, mining companies are able to negotiate with just a chief rather than with a whole community of people and have people removed from their land for it to be mined. Another reason is local government is really struggling in a lot of South Africa, and having a different, much cheaper form of administration and governance around the country has lightened some of the load that would have gone on to local government. So instead of expanding the reach of local government and providing real equal citizenship to everyone, this is governance on the cheap. There are many more reasons, but those are two of the most spoken about. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Tipe. I appreciate that. How do I? I'll do this. I'm aware of time, and so, you know, as Dr. Tipe has revealed, right, there is the work of the South African democratic project was to undo an enormous amount of discrimination, and so it was a large undertaking, and the results have been highly uneven. Briefly, you know, the attempt to realize second generation rights, there have been huge investments in social grants, there have been huge investments in infrastructure, education, electrification, building houses. For example, 60% of children receive a child support grant today, which is direct cash infusions into the pockets of the poorest, overwhelmingly mothers. At the same time, South Africa remains one of the most unequal countries on the globe. There has been economic growth, but it's been overwhelmingly jobless. It's one of the highest. It has the highest unemployment in Africa. Again, overwhelmingly for Black South African women. The power grid drastically needs an updating because, in both physical and metaphorical terms, the structure of power was never designed to enable everyone to have power. Basic services are very limited, and then there's high levels of gender-based violence. But I think it's tempting sometimes to think that all of these are just sort of African problems, especially in the West. And so I want to just call attention to the moment of the 1990s and the early 1990s when South African was launching this new project, right? And so the contrast of Mandela running on a platform, the ANC running on a platform of a better life for all, versus a president we might be more familiar with, Clinton, ran on a platform of ending welfare as we know it. And sort of the results of their actions were, you know, on the one side, attempt to redress past inequality, to expand local protection, legal protections, and expand government grants, versus a massive shrinking of welfare provisions via limiting limits, limiting eligibility, and so forth. And so, you know, our first world lived realities are different. But we can also think that perhaps we don't have a lot to be smug about. We have increased spending, massively government spending, but it's overwhelmingly been in law and order and not in welfare provisions. So this isn't actually a reduction in government spending. And across the world, and you know, here is the UK, what we're seeing is a huge increase in the number of folks living in extreme poverty, which is defined as living on less than $2.15 a day. Such that in 2022, about 8% of the population. That's a lot less in places like the UK, which invests differently. And I don't want to sort of say that this is only a US thing. If we look at the larger larger distribution of poverty, the U.S. is just this sort of little sliver. But if we think about democracy, if we think about citizenship, we need to reckon with the fact that half of the global population today lives on less than $6.85. So why does that matter? Well, it matters because going back to what Noku Tula said, and taking seriously articulations like hers, the idea that citizenship is tied to a person's ability to invest in the relationships that are important to them. Her wish was for a job with a salary that would be enough to support herself and her family. How radical is that? That's a good question. And so I really take as inspiration a quote from Taylor Goody, which is the idea that citizenship, and if we understand democracy as laying the foundation for citizenship, as both a normative and an empirical concept that describes a status but also energizes demands about what citizenship, what national membership should be. I use the concept of relational citizenship to say, what if we all could invest in political structures that allowed people to support their relationships and those that are meaningful to them? So be it kin, be it non-kin, what if we all sought out a reality in which we could have relational citizenship, the very thing that Noku Tula was desiring? So thank you, everyone, for your time and patience, because I know we went over. Thank you, Dr. Tipe, and I will turn things over to my colleagues.